Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Pope is headed to Mexico for a six-day trip. He's expected to visit Ciudad Juarez, a border city that's been ravaged by the drug war. The trip will also include his first visit to the U.S.-Mexico border. Today's guest, journalist Alfredo Corchado, reports that the Pope's visit comes as the Obama administration faces increasing criticism from his own party and the Hispanic community over renewed raids on undocumented families in the United States. The administration has deported more unauthorized immigrants than any other, and it's happening as migration from Mexico falls. The Pope arrives just days after the murder of the third journalist in Mexico this year. Annabel Flores Salazar was a 32-year-old mother of two, and she was killed in the Gulf Coast state of Veracruz. Also, 11 priests have been killed in the past 3 years. And joining us to discuss coverage of these issues is Alfredo Corchado, an award-winning journalist and Mexico City bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. Alfredo is also a professor at Arizona State University, Cronkite School of Journalism, where he co-directs the Borderland Project. And Alfredo has spent the morning in Ciudad Juarez trying to get his media credentials. Hi, Alfredo. Thank you for joining us and taking a break from that.
Always a pleasure to talk to you and listeners in the San Francisco area.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you. We are also joined today by The Intercept's Lee Fong. Lee recently questioned Hillary Clinton about her Wall Street speeches, which are now getting major media attention. By now, you've probably heard that Goldman Sachs paid Hillary Clinton $675,000 for giving three speeches. When Lee Fong asked Clinton if she would release the transcripts, she laughed. Well, this issue continues to follow her. She recently canceled a fundraiser with a venture capitalist in Boston that has ties to Bain Capital, that is Mitt Romney's old firm. Last night, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton met for yet another debate. This is just a few days after Bernie Sanders won big in New Hampshire. He got 60% of the vote. Hillary Clinton got 38%. Sanders won almost every demographic. And at the debate, and also just in the election overall, one of the big questions is, how much influence does money have on policies? And how are the media reporting on this? Lee Fong covers these issues very closely. He's an investigative reporter with The Intercept and author of the book, The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. And he's got a number of news stories out this week that follow the money and report on lobbyists. And Lee joins us in studio. Hi, Lee. Thanks for coming back in.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So on Your Calls at Media Roundtable, we always start off on a positive note and highlight good reporting that stood out this week. So, Lee Fong, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I hate to drop an article that's related to my own, but the Politico piece by Ben White, you know, it's the Clinton campaign has been almost a fortress of not allowing reporters to ask questions. She hasn't had a press conference in, I believe, 80 days or something. You know, it's been very tough to get any answers. But Ben White talked to a number of people on Wall Street who attended some of these Goldman Sachs speeches, and has been really the only reporter to actually report and paraphrase some of the things that she said. So, you know, he did a follow-up piece. He did a piece 2 years ago, but he did a follow-up this week that was very interesting, noting that, according to some of the attendees, Hillary Clinton sounded kind of like a managing director of Goldman Sachs, giving a very kind of rousing speech to the bankers. So it was an interesting piece, and it was very unique.
Yep, and we'll talk more about that later in the show. This piece is what Clinton said in her paid speeches, recalled one attendee. She sounded more like a Goldman Sachs managing director. So kudos to Ben White at Politico, and we will talk about that later in the show. What about you, Alfredo? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I thought it was a brilliant article by Ignacio Alvarado Alvarez and the photographer Keith Dannemiller for Al Jazeera America. And it was a piece about the workers' strike that's happening here in Ciudad Juarez. Workers who are making $8-9 a day, and they've been fighting for months for a 50-cent increase. I mean, just 50 cents. Some of them have been fired. Some of them are being threatened with legal action. obviously the timing is crucial. I mean, this comes just days before the Pope arrives in Ciudad Juarez, and he's expected to highlight the human rights, dignity for workers. And this is a perfect laboratory for the Pope. I mean, you have the issue of inequality, corruption, and what he calls the dangers and the evils of capitalism. The article it focuses on one of the women that was striking, Gregoria Medina, and her fight. She works at a giant printing company, I think from Kentucky, Lexmark. It just kind of gives a whole sense of the issue that I think will be very, very poignant during the Pope's visit.
Hmm. So kudos to Ignacio Alvarez, and you named the photographer?
Keith Gannon-Miller. It was a joint effort. I mean, Keith has some incredible photos that they really tell the whole story. Ignacio is a well-known journalist in Mexico, and they both did this for Al Jazeera America.
So kudos to them at Al Jazeera America, and we will put links to these pieces at yourcallradio.org. And Alfredo, before we dive in and talk about the Pope, you are in Ciudad Juarez right now trying to get your media credentials. And, it was so sad to read about Anabel Flores Salazar, who was killed in the Gulf Coast state of Veracruz recently, a 32-year-old mother of two. And I've been reading in-depth reporting just about these journalists that put their lives on the line in Mexico. Some of them are now going underground. They're starting these amazing independent outlets because they want to get the story out. Now that the Pope is on his way to Mexico, how is that going to change for the journalists who put their lives on the line on a regular basis?
I mean, Anabel sadly was one of three journalists killed in 2016, and I think the other two journalists were just killed in the last week or two. So it remains a huge, huge issue. I mean, you can't call yourself a developing first world country if you can't even protect freedom of expression. The Pope's visited 6 days and is going through different cities. Each place, each region represents a deep, deep wound for Mexico. And one of them, obviously, is the killing of journalists. And he's in Mexico City, he's in Ecatepec, and state of Mexico, Chiapas, Morelia, Ciudad Juarez. Some of these regions are areas that people call regions of silence, where people, with journalists, are threatened into silence, and where the drug traffickers, the organized crime, control these areas. So it'll be interesting to see what the Pope says and whether he's able to get across to the Mexican authorities that you can't continue to kill journalists and have a 90% to 95% impunity rate. That means that less than 10% of all cases are ever solved. Some people say the numbers are actually higher. It comes at a crucial time for journalists, but also in general. I mean, it's more than 120,000 people have been killed, and the same impunity rate for these people apply for these victims applies.
And Alfredo, you were threatened back in 2008 because you covered the drug cartels.
Well, 2007 and so on. I mean, it's covering the drug traffickers is, especially when you start reporting about the money and you start following the money, it becomes, they don't really care whether you're American or you're Mexican. Obviously, if you're an American journalist, there's much more protection. You can actually call your editor and get out of the country, leave the country. And you can also, make members of organized crime think twice before they act, because you say, look, you're a U.S. citizen. You don't want to threaten your 10, 20, 40 billion dollar industry, because you want to believe as a journalist that there might be consequences. And I think that's helped in my situation. That's also helped a lot of other foreign journalists who I know who've been under similar circumstances. You can't say the same about our colleagues in Mexico. I mean, you're threatened, and it's not only you who are threatened, but your family, your friends are threatened. So oftentimes you have no choice but to, not report anything, not say anything. Mm-hmm. And as you said, a lot of people are, beginning to look at their own websites, looking at online journalism, or they will call a colleague from outside or a colleague with more protection and say, hey, this is a great story, this is an important story, please tell the story, because we can't.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Pope is going to visit Ciudad Juarez. He has invited relatives of some of the more than 20,000 people missing in the country. He's invited relatives of the 43 Mexican college students who were kidnapped and killed. He will be visiting Chiapas. He's expected to visit the border and express solidarity with immigrants. This is a pretty significant trip, Alfredo. What are you looking for as a journalist?
It's very significant. I think if you're a member of the Enrique Peña Nieto administration, the Mexican president of Mexico, or the Obama administration, you know, you're both a little excited, but I think also very nervous. I mean, he's going to bring up all these issues that I think the Mexican government has tried hard for the last 2 or 3 years to underplay or to overlook. I think one of the most poignant moments will come right here in Ciudad Juarez when he walks towards the Rio Grande and says a prayer for the immigrants, the refugees who have tried making it across and have died trying. I mean, in the last 15, 20 years, more than 6,000 people have died. And I was just talking to some refugees yesterday on the El Paso side who will be there. I'm from the U.S. side, and they will be there watching the Pope and praying with the Pope. It's a very, very significant moment because I think he's going to also highlight, even if he doesn't say much, I mean, just the image of the Pope walking towards the Rio Grande, and you see this fence separating these two countries. It'll make people remember that the Obama administration has deported more unauthorized immigrants than any other. Mm. And it's happening as illegal migration from Mexico continues to fall.
Right, and you wrote about this in your latest report. This got attention also at last night's debate. And today, the L.A. School District announced that ICE agents cannot enter schools, and the number of congregations providing sanctuary to these people are growing. Alfredo, you've done so much reporting on this. What explains the rise in deportations under the Obama administration?
Well, that's a big question that we've all been asking. We've been asking people close to the administration. They keep saying, look, you know, we're doing this in a very humanitarian way. We told people, especially from Central America, at some point you're going to have to go back, and they're enforcing the laws. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, in talking to these refugees last night, they're saying, look, we're no different than the refugees in Syria, and yet there's much more empathy, much more sympathy for those regions than there are for one. And we're not trying to compare, we're not trying to downplay the situation in Europe, but I wish that the Pope can send this message to refugees around the world and say, look, we're no different than anyone else.
And Alfredo, just quickly, I know you have to go back to try to get your credentials. What are your thoughts on context? Because it's very rare that you read about the effects of U.S. foreign policy on this mass migration. And I often think about this documentary, Harvest of Empire, by Juan Gonzalez, who takes a look at every country in Central and South America and looks at U.S. foreign policy and why, over history, so many people have fled. I mean, there's a reason why people are leaving.
Well, there's a reason, and a big, big reason has to do with U.S. policy. I mean, if you look at Central America, I mean, you know, the region has been ravaged since the late 70s, 1980s, and it's really a war that, for many of these people, I mean, it still continues. You have U.S. demand for drugs, you have gangs. I mean, one of the victims we talked to last night was she basically fled with her four children after her husband was killed by maras, and some of these maras were trained, came of age as gang members in the L.A., Southern California area. So you have this, you know, big core responsibility that oftentimes Americans sort of look the other way and don't remember these wars that continue to impact these people today.
Well, Alfredo, I know you have to leave us, so thank you so much for joining us, and we will be following your reporting over the course of the Pope's visit.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That is Alfredo Corchado. He's an award-winning journalist and Mexico City bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. He is currently in Ciudad Juarez. He had to leave us because he's trying to get his press credentials as the Pope is headed for Mexico for a 6-day trip. And we're going to now talk about media coverage of the election. Li Feng is with us. He covers the influence of money in politics. He's an investigative reporter with The Intercept, former reporter with The Nation. Li is author of the book, The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. And now I would like to welcome Thomas Frank to the show. Thomas writes regularly for Salon. He's a former columnist with The Wall Street Journal. He is the author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? He's got a new one coming out. I love the title. It's called Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. It takes a look at the Democratic Party's failure over the last couple of decades to do anything meaningful about income inequality. Hi, Tom. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, how are you today?
Good. Thank you for joining us. So let's dive in and talk about the election coverage. It's getting really interesting. And looking at how the media framed the New Hampshire victories for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, they are basically saying that these are two outsiders, two renegades who have won, without really looking at the major, major differences between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Li, what are your thoughts just about that kind of shallow frame?
Well, look, I mean, the way the major mainstream media covers the election is fairly arbitrary and based on superficial factors like, you know, the expectation game polling. You know, I was in New Hampshire recently, and just to give you kind of a flavor of what it's like to be there on the ground, you know, surrounded by, you know, maybe 24, 25 other reporters, I spent a whole day on one Saturday at a New Hampshire Republican Party event, and literally every question for at least the entire morning portion of the event was asking every single Republican candidate what they thought about rumors that Michael Bloomberg would run. I mean, not a single question about anything in the news, any issues, any concerns of voters. It was all kind of like this horse race game of who's up, who's down. And so when we see this kind of puerile look at, hey, you know, here's a candidate that has cast themselves as anti-establishment, pro-establishment, you know, and here's someone who's down in the polls and went up a slight bit. I mean, that's basically the big takeaway. It's very unfortunate.
Thomas Frank, Norman Solomon recently wrote that elite media often blur distinctions between right-wing populism and progressive populism, as though there's not all that much difference between appealing to xenophobia and racism on the one hand and appealing for social justice and humanistic solidarity on the other. He says journalists cannot resist lumping Trump and Sanders together as rabble-rousing outliers. But in the real world, the differences are vast.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. So I live here in Washington, D.C., or in the suburbs. And, you know, I read two newspapers every day. I used to read more than that, but they stopped delivering the Washington Times in the suburbs. So I only read the New York Times and the Washington Post. And one of my hobbies lately has been tallying the number of anti-Sanders op-eds that they're running. Now they slacked off. I think the Washington Post ran three today, but they also for their first time ever they ran something that was like vaguely pro Sanders, which is a first, I believe, for them. But usually it's three or four a day denouncing him, and you know it's a. I'm sorry, I forgot where I was going with this, but it intrigues me the way opinion journalism is so forthrightly, you know, there's not even any effort to be, you know, to be even-handed. I'm talking about the Democratic primaries here. Now, it changed a little after the New Hampshire, you know, after the New Hampshire verdict, which was such a landslide for Bernie Sanders. But up until that happened, the New York Times was. The New York Times op-ed page was basically acting like a kind of, it felt like reading, Hillary flyers, you know?
Well, I want to talk about New Hampshire because...
But that's a very peculiar thing. I'm sorry, I shouldn't interrupt you. I should
no,
keep my mouth
no,
shut.
Please.
I haven't done a radio interview in like 2 years, so I forgot.
Really?
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Please, jump in at any time. Let's talk, though, about New Hampshire because we move on so quickly. And, you know, last year, most people had never heard of Bernie Sanders. He was down 50 points. He's running against one of the most well-known female political figures in the world. He won in New Hampshire 60% to 38%. He got every single demographic other than seniors and people making more than $200,000 a year. And so, Li, what struck me is Anna Greenberg on NPR, after Bernie Sanders gave his speech, she called it processy and schizophrenic, and then kind of just moved on. I mean, what struck me was there was really no analysis about why Bernie Sanders won so big in New Hampshire. That's what struck me on the night of that victory.
Yeah, it struck me too. And I didn't hear that quote, but I've heard many similar ones. If you just looked on Twitter and saw the kind of condescending remarks from mainstream journalists mocking the length of a speech, you know, with no regard to the content or the actual kind of unprecedented victory. I mean, here is a self-described Democratic socialist down 50 points in the poll, running against the entire Democratic Party in New Hampshire. I mean, virtually every elected official in the state, the big party institutions, the superdelegates, the folks who have been part of the party establishment, also just in the region, you know, lots of politicians from Maine, from Vermont, the governor of Vermont, from Massachusetts, drove up to New Hampshire to campaign for Clinton. I mean, it was the airwaves were saturated with pro-Clinton advertisements. They bussed and flew people in to knock on doors. And again, the polls showed Clinton up by 40 or 50 points only a few months ago, and here she crashes and loses by some 20 or so points. I mean, that's a revolutionary type election, but for journalists covering this, the fact that Bernie Sanders ran such a positive campaign that was focused on issues that I think journalists have contempt for, issues concerning poverty reduction and climate change and campaign finance, it was a personal affront to them. So that's why I think you saw that sneering response.
And Thomas Frank also, Hillary Clinton got the endorsement of every major media outlet in New Hampshire and every major Democratic politician.
And by the way, Lee just got it exactly right. He hit the nail on the head there, that these people the sort of mainstream media hold Bernie Sanders' ideas in contempt. That is exactly the right way to put it. They're not, these are ideas that they regard as being beneath argument. That these aren't even things that you really have to argue. You just have to laugh at them. You have to brush them aside. And I think that I'm going to try to link this back to this book that I've been working on for the last year. And so the topics are you know, foremost in my mind. But do you remember the old liberal media critique, right? The idea that the press is like biased way to the left and all this sort of thing.
Right.
And well, okay, not only is that like, flatly disproven by the way but there is something going on here. This sort of the herd-like endorsement of Hillary and the contemptuous disregard for what Sanders is arguing for is really telling. You know, this has been a very revealing moment in the media the last few weeks, and I think people will be studying it for years to come. It is fascinating. We could spend the whole show talking about it now that I think about it.
Well, we've got 30 more minutes, so let's do it. So the top two issues among Democratic primary voters in New Hampshire were income inequality and the economy, with each being selected by about one-third of Democrats. Nearly half of Dems say that Bernie Sanders is the only candidate who they can trust to deal with income inequality. And so, Thomas, your new book, Listen Liberal, is about the Democratic Party's failure over the last couple of decades to do anything meaningful about inequality.
But at the same time, to do things that really please the kind of people who write newspaper op-eds. I mean, to really make them happy. You know, like you take a guy like Bill Clinton, the presidency of Bill Clinton. The Washington Post loved this man. By their standards, he is an ideal president. That is what being a Democrat is all about, is doing what Bill Clinton did. And they've, slightly less enthusiastic about Barack Obama, but still, that's what a Democratic presidency looks like. And what Bernie Sanders is offering are things that are just like so, that go so deeply against the grain of what that kind of Democrat believes in. When I say that kind of Democrat, I'm coming very quickly to the point, which is the argument that I make in Listen Liberal. By the way, the title of the book should be pronounced in a certain way. There's a kind of Kansas twang to it. Listen Liberal. But the idea is that the Democratic Party is a class party in the kind of 19th century European sense of the word. It's a party that represents a single socioeconomic class and does it really, really well. And everybody else is just along for the ride. But the class that they represent is the professional managerial class. And they do this, and someone like Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton are perfect examples of this, of the kind of people whose interests are very well represented by the Democratic Party. And the people who identify most closely with the Democratic Party love to brush things off by referring to what they learned in economics in college. I mean, what the way Lee put it, you know, that they regard him with contempt is exactly the way they deal with ideas that they, that they don't agree with. It's to pull some this sort of expertise on them. You know, and they do this all the time in the Washington Post and the New York Times.
I just want to add, you know, one thing, if you read the columnists, if you listen to the pundits, if you just listen to maybe an hour of MSNBC, you hear all of these Democratic pundits, the folks who speak on behalf of the party, Clinton surrogates, at least during the New Hampshire campaign, you know, ad nauseum saying, you know, well, here's the one issue that distinguishes Clinton and Sanders. It's this gun issue. I mean, look, Bernie Sanders voted against or voted for this 2005 gun liability vote that, you know, exempts gun manufacturers from liability. I mean, look, we can talk about that policy, and it's certainly problematic. But, I mean, if you just actually walked around and talked to New Hampshire voters, I mean, a lot of folks had never heard of this before. It feels very contrived. I mean, this was back in 2005. If this is, like, the most important issue for gun safety, and Clinton's now saying it's the only way to stand up to the NRA, where was Clinton in 2006 or 2007 or 2008?
By the way, you're correct there, I would add on, if that was really your foremost concern, you would have voted for Mitt Romney over Barack Obama. At the time, he had a better gun control record than Obama did. As governor of Massachusetts, he'd been pretty good on the issue.
No, that's a fantastic point. And like, I think it speaks to what Thomas is saying. You know, one of the reasons that they focus on this is because so they don't have to talk about the kind of bread and butter economic issues, so they can talk about, you know, personal corruption that is a factor between Clinton and Sanders. And then, moreover, if you look at who actually funds the gun control debate, it's a bunch of billionaires who want to make this the focus of the Democratic Party, not fundamental economic justice.
Well, let's talk more about that after the break and the influence of money in politics. Lee Fong is an investigative reporter with The Intercept. Thomas Frank is out with, or he's author of the forthcoming book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with your host, Lauren Schiller. Stay with us here on Local Public Radio, KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll rebroadcast a conversation about the documentary The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. The film premieres on PBS on Tuesday, so I hope you can check it out. And then on Tuesday, we will be joined by Jane Mayer. She is out with a book called Dark Money, Speaking of Money in Politics. We'll be following the money with Jane Mayer on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. Today we're talking about coverage of elections and specifically coverage of money in politics. Lee Fong is an investigative reporter with The Intercept. Thomas Frank writes for Salon, former columnist with The Wall Street Journal, founding editor of The Baffler. He's got a new book coming out, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. It looks at the Democratic Party's failure over the last couple of decades to do anything meaningful about income inequality. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think about coverage of the election and these very important issues about money and politics? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Just quickly, Lee, before you went to break, you were talking about who's actually funding the gun control debate. Can you give us more information on that?
Well, yeah, it's Michael Bloomberg, but then also a number of other folks in Wall Street. They've made this a top issue, and you know, in many ways, I sympathize with some of their positions. But the way that this kind of shakes out in a practical sense is that they are pushing the gun issue at the forefront to push the other kind of economic bread and butter issues to the wayside. And so, you know, while you know I might agree with a lot of the gun control policies that they support, if you actually look at how this shakes out, it's very contrived. And it's clear what the purpose is of this type of politics.
So then to talk about the issues that are being raised, or at least trying to be raised in the campaign, you've got a piece, Top Hillary Clinton Advisors and Fundraisers Lobbied Against Obamacare and Dodd-Frank. You report that Hillary Clinton is campaigning as the guardian of Obama's accomplishments, but her campaign has been relying on a team of fundraisers, many of whom spent much of the last 7 years as consultants or lobbyists for business interests working to obstruct Obamacare and Dodd-Frank. And yet, on the campaign trail, she's praising both of these policies.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of amazing thing. You know, because Secretary Clinton can't really distinguish herself against Bernie Sanders on a future vision for the country on economic issues, on health care, on Wall Street, whatever, what she's doing is she's campaigning as the guardian of President Obama's signature policy accomplishments, Affordable Care Act and Dodd-Frank. The problem is, you know, it feels like, you know, this is just a manufactured campaign issue because she's filled her staff and her fundraisers with folks who spent the last 7 years being hired and making a lot of money from business interests to lobby against Obama's signature policy accomplishments. And you know, for a lot of these big issues, you know, it comes down to not repealing the entire bill. No one's going to do that. No Democratic president, and probably not a Republican president, would do that either. What comes down to it is looking at the substantive provisions and the different planks of each bill. And that's where the money is. That's where a lot of her advisors and strategists have cashed in because they're rolling back Dodd-Frank rules on big banks like the Volcker Rule. They're getting paid by the medical device company to push and repeal the medical device tax, which is a big part of the law. The health insurance industry is trying to push Medicare Advantage back to the forefront, and that's a very wasteful program. Basically, the way we fund health reform is by repealing the subsidies to Medicare Advantage that are hugely wasteful. So it's just incredible hypocrisy that Clinton would cast herself as the guardian of Obama's presidential accomplishments while surrounding herself with folks who have cashed in and obstructing those accomplishments.
Talk about how you're learning about these groups and how you're finding this information, because some of these groups most of us have never heard of. You're writing about these consultants with the Dewey Square Group, and then when it comes – that's the healthcare. And then when it comes to Dodd-Frank, you're writing about the Benenson Strategy Group. So how do you learn about this? Where's this information?
Well, you know, for me, I cover lobbying, and, you know, these are folks that you never see on television, or you see them on television, but they're not identified as Dewey Square. A lot of these folks actually are CNN pundits, like I think Jill Alper is a principal there, but she goes on TV, but she's just described as a, you know, Democratic strategist. They don't say what her actual job title is, which is principal with the Dewey Square Group. But what the Dewey Square Group does, it's basically what's known as an astroturf lobbying firm. This is, you know, they do some direct lobbying of lawmakers, but what they specialize in is that when a corporation needs public support, they're hired to then, you know, go to a civil rights group or go to another third party group or create a whole fake group and say, you know, here's, you know, grassroots support for your policy. So that, you know, Dewey Square was paid by Enron to create the perception of public support for energy deregulation. They were paid by the telecom industry to, you know, create fake groups for supporting telecom policies. And back in 2009, with the health insurance industry, you know, they didn't want health reform, particularly because health reform would be funded by cuts to Medicare Advantage, this hugely wasteful program. The health insurance industry hired Dewey Square Group to create the appearance of public opposition to Medicare Advantage reform. So, you know, they got caught actually in Massachusetts. One of the editors of a local paper there noticed that there are all these kind of weird letters coming in, and letters to the editor calling against cuts for Medicare Advantage. And they started calling the folks who had supposedly written these letters, and they realized that they didn't write these letters. They didn't. These were senior citizens who had no idea this was even happening. So, you know, Dewey Square was caught forging these letters. But, you know, that's not the first time. They've been caught forging letters on other issue campaigns to other regulators in the past. And they said it was just like an aberration, but it's clearly not an aberration.
So what about this kind of reporting, Thomas Frank? I mean, what should reporters do when they hear Hillary Clinton, who has made so much money off of Wall Street by giving speeches, say that this money is not going to influence me? When I get into the White House, I'm going to take on Wall Street and jail the bankers if that's what they deserve.
Oh, my God. Can I just add that what Lee described is very typical Washington, D.C. sort of story. These are the city is filled with firms like that. That's one of the reasons it's the richest city in America. The economy here runs on these people who are able to fake or perform liberalism, let's put it that way, to sort of perform liberalism and lobby various Democrats, you know, make any issue you want seem like it's empowering the downtrodden or liberating humanity or whatever it happens to be. When he mentioned electricity power deregulation and telecom deregulation, two of the great like triumphs of the Bill Clinton era, by the way. But that sort of strategy, I wrote about that years ago when they were debating the Employee Free Choice Act, which was a card check. It would have made it really easy to join a labor union or to form a labor union in the United States. And all of these Democratic lobby shops were mobilized against it, which is fascinating. But that's how this city rolls. It's one of the things I really like about Bernie Sanders is he has very little to do with that part of with that side of Washington, D.C. But that's just my opinion. I would actually, what I look at in, you're asking like, what should reporters do about that?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these things are, you know, reporters are supposed to be covering that sort of thing. It isn't done as much as it used to be. But there was, reporters know this stuff is out there. If you dig hard enough, you can find that sort of thing. It's not, they should be, I mean, we should be hearing lots and lots more about that. And that is especially true with the Clintons. Look, look at the people who surrounded the Clintons when Bill was president and, you know, all these years, and the Clinton Foundation, and when Hillary was at the State Department. You know, and you'll find a whole, you know, a rogues gallery of people who are not exactly the most liberal folks in the world. I'm wondering when they're going to start talking about Rahm Emanuel. I mean, this guy's been a Clinton, you know, a Clinton sidekick for decades, and what he's doing as mayor of Chicago is deeply, deeply unpopular. You know, when is that going to come up in this presidential contest? And there's many more Clinton friends like that who are out there doing very embarrassing things. You know, and I wonder when Hillary's going to be required to distance herself from these people. But it's all very well known. I mean, these are all, you know, famous people that I'm talking about here, well-known Democratic leaders. But can I talk about a variation on this thing?
Sure.
Which is that I think the Democratic Party over the last 30 years had a sort of ideological, well, it's not that I think they did. They did have an ideological shift. And a shift in who made up the rank and file of the party, the kind of people that the party listens to. And so it went from being, a very different kind of political party in the 1960s to what it is today, where it has this kind of on-again, off-again relationship with Wall Street, where, you know, they sort of love Wall Street, but they know it's embarrassing now, so they have to kind of keep it secret. But at the end of the day, yeah, they really love Wall Street, and they love Silicon Valley. Oh, my God, do they love Silicon Valley. Look at Secretary Clinton's record as Secretary of State, when she was Secretary of State, and all of her interactions with Silicon Valley people and with the Silicon Valley ideology. Or look at President Obama right now. I mean, the people from Google are basically in and out of the White House all the time. You know, they have Democrats hold certain industries in very high esteem because they identify with them. This is going back to this idea that I outlined earlier of the Democrats as a class party. And for 30 or 40 years, Democrats have been writing these books and these magazine articles about how the Democratic Party has to identify itself with the creative class. You've heard this term before, right?
Right.
Or the wired workers, you know, this kind of thing. But it's always with a certain class of people. And that class is, they'll, you know, you dig a little deeper, and that class is, that's who lives, that's who works on Wall Street, that's who works in Silicon Valley, that's who works in Big Pharma. And these are three industries that they treat with kid gloves, you know, they don't dare prosecute them. These are industries that can do no wrong, you know, like Amazon. When do you think they're going to go after Amazon for antitrust, you know? I mean, for violations of antitrust that appear to be, you know, very obvious to you and me, but the Justice Department can't see it. Doesn't look like anything to them. It's because these people are in the Democratic Party ideology. These are the industries you want to encourage. These are the people you want to foster. You want to do everything you can for these people. But working class people, you know, whatever.
Thomas Frank is author of the forthcoming book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, looks at the Democratic Party's failure over the past few decades to do anything meaningful about income inequality. Thomas Frank writes for Salon. He's a former columnist with the Wall Street Journal. And Lee Fong is an investigative reporter with The Intercept, former reporter with The Nation. He's got a number of really good articles out this week about lobbyists. He's got one he's got one about the Black Caucus and the lobbyists behind the it was very confusing this week, actually.
Yeah, you know, let me just say, whatever happens in this election, and God knows what's going to happen. I think Secretary Clinton is probably at the end of the day going to clinch it. But look, I love that we're having this debate about what these institutions that typically make up the Democratic Party, what do they actually function as, right? So yesterday when the Congressional Black Caucus supposedly endorsed Secretary Clinton very quickly, that was in all the news. It was on the evening news. All the big headlines said CBC endorsed. Well, we took a look at this. Actually, this was the Congressional Black Caucus Political Action Committee, which, you know, does not necessarily represent, you know, all 40-some members of the Congressional Black Caucus. It's the majority of the board that actually made this endorsement decision are corporate lobbyists. And they made that decision very swiftly without interacting or, you know, asking for the approval of the majority of the CBC members. And if you actually look at these lobbyists, these are not folks who are very friendly to the progressive agenda or even the African American community. I mean, these are folks who are lobbying for cigarette companies. These are folks who are lobbyists for Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, you know, the drug that's fueled the heroin crisis in America. So these are the people who actually made that decision. But then if you look at the media coverage of this supposed CBC endorsement, everyone's writing in the mainstream media, oh, this shows that Secretary Clinton is loved by the African-American community, that she has this deep, abiding bond that can't be broken by any competitor. So it's just incredible if you actually look at the nitty-gritty of who makes these approval decisions and how these groups actually function.
And that piece is Hillary Clinton's Congressional Black Caucus PAC endorsement approved by board awash in lobbyists by today's guest, Lee Fong, with The Intercept. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. We are talking about media coverage of the elections and specifically money in politics and the influence of money in politics. Let's hear from Christopher in San Francisco. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on. I'm a fellow journalist as well, and what strikes me is how unbelievably unempirical the mainstream media are being and how they're reflecting their bias constantly in so many different ways, from the horse race coverage even to the deeper policy level questions. You know, so they don't raise any questions about Hillary's background and positions when she was first lady, relevant to African Americans, for instance, like the crime bill and welfare reform fiascos. They don't even look at the, they might mention the polls, but they don't really talk about, you know, how this is really a wide open race at this point. But even in the horse race level,
they don't
actual facts. And it's just, it's remarkable. You know, they're going to be biased, but they're not even really being the kinds of reporters that they claim to be in that regard. I just wanted to raise that issue, and you know, I have a piece coming out soon in The Atlantic that I wanted to mention also called The Pragmatic Case for Bernie Sanders, and I think this is part of the problem. The media are not, they're presenting it as wide-eyed idealists versus hard-nosed pragmatists.
Well, thank you for calling. That's Christopher Cook. He's a really great journalist here in San Francisco. Thanks for calling, Chris. We'll look for that story. What about that, Thomas? And we just got an email from another listener who wanted us to mention this alternate piece. New York Times post-debate coverage goes full infomercial for Clinton. Three stories in the New York Times today. Hillary Clinton is calm, cool, and effective. In Democratic debate, Hillary Clinton paints Bernie Sanders' plans as unrealistic.
Yeah, well, I just spent the last year doing exactly the research that the caller asked for, you know, about Hillary Clinton and her, where she was during the welfare reform debate. It's not hard to dig this stuff up. You just have to go out and do it. But you have to want to do it, first of all, you know. And I wrote all this, by the way, before I knew that Bernie Sanders was probably going to run for the presidency, but it didn't occur to me that he might actually have a shot at it. So I wrote all this under the assumption that Hillary Clinton was probably going to be the Democratic Party nominee, and I think she still is. I mean, this was visible a long time ago. And yeah, it's all out there. I mean, as I say, if you want, you can dig it all up, and it is a shabby story indeed, the story of the Clinton years. From the standpoint of today, if you go back and look at, as I mentioned earlier in the show, if you go back and look at the way they talked about Bill Clinton at the time, they thought he was the ideal Democratic president. This is exactly what a Democratic presidency should be like. They all said this back in the 1990s.
So, Thomas, I mean, your book is coming out at a good time. We're going to have you on when it's out next month. Can you just give us a quick preview? I mean, what did you uncover during your research that is not getting much attention right now?
Well, it's a work of history, you know, that comes up to the present, so it's also, you know, current events, sort of, but none of it is getting any attention. Well, okay, there's the thing that is getting attention now that sort of surprises me. When I started doing the research on the achievements of the Clinton era, you know, Bill Clinton's presidency, at first it was kind of hard to figure out what did he do? What did he actually get done as president? Because all anybody talks about when they talk about his presidency are the scandals and the wars with the Republicans, and then, of course, the prosperity of the country. What he actually did as president is almost forgotten, but when you start digging it up, the welfare reform, the crime bill, the deregulations, NAFTA, all of it, none of them were good. They're all terrible. And the one that has, I write about all of these in more or less great detail, let me put it that way, but the one that really where things have changed dramatically. When I started writing the book, I phoned a number of experts about criminal justice and mass incarceration, and I was the crime bill of 1994 is something that drove me crazy at the time, that made me really angry at the time, and then writing about it, I felt all that coming back, and I would talk to these experts, and they'd say, you know, Tom, you this might bother you personally, but nobody else cares about it. I'm just going to tell you, this is a subject that nobody else cares about. And then Black Lives Matter happened, and now today everybody cares about it. So, but let me say this, we're just only getting started on that story. Once you start digging, there's tons more out there. It's a really shabby story. But my account goes back well before Clinton. Clinton was the culmination of a series of Democratic reform efforts in the 70s and the 80s, and it all sort of culminated with this guy. But the main idea behind all of these reform efforts, and they were scattered all over the political map, if you will, but the main thing uniting them was this, what I mentioned earlier, this class idea. That the Democrats could no longer be the party of the working class, and the Democrats had to become the party of the creative class, or whatever you want to call it, but basically the professional managerial class, which some people would say, you know, Wall Street, we have to become that. And Clinton, if that's your standard for what the Democratic Party should be and how they should operate, Bill Clinton's presidency was massively successful because he achieved that transition. He locked it down.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and we're getting bombarded with listener emails saying that you're both right about elite media bias, and can you elaborate on that? I was thinking about that Tyndall report in December that looked at the major media. For example, ABC World News Tonight devoted 81 minutes to Donald Trump, 1 minute to Bernie Sanders. This is pretty consistent for the national media
in
December.
Yeah, and like ABC News, that's a great example. First 11 months, I believe, of last year, less than 1 minute, I believe, to Bernie Sanders. But lots of minutes last night to that silly CBC PAC endorsement, which was misreported. I mean, there's your contrast right there. And it's not just in the opinion section of the major newspapers. It's in the news section as well. I mean, the New York Times just a few weeks ago had kind of a silly headline that said that pro-Bernie Sanders super PACs were outspending pro-Hillary Clinton super PACs. And what they did was they took a very kind of esoteric version or classification of super PAC spending and said that because a group of nurses in the nurses union were, you know, renting a bus and busing around people to promote Bernie Sanders, look, here's the dog bites or man bites dog story, the anti-big money crusader Bernie Sanders is, you know, benefiting from lots more super PAC money than Clinton. I mean, the story was just wrong, right? Like, if you look at total super PAC spending, Clinton's got a whole fleet of them, and they spent something like $18 million. The nurses have spent something around $1 million. It's an 18-to-1 difference, but they reported it as there's more pro Bernie Sanders money.
And what about the larger question about the media and how they're influencing the election?
I mean, they have total control. I mean, they've less control in this election because people can go on the internet and look up some of these things. I mean, that's the kind of the other side of this election. People are going on Facebook and debating and Googling and sharing things that they couldn't have found out in previous elections. People talk about 2008 as the first internet election, but that was still kind of top down. That was still through meetup groups and listservs. People are now doing a lot of independent research and journalism. But still, I mean, the big news media organizations are still the gatekeepers. We don't talk about Ricky Ray Rector. I mean, Bill Clinton executing a mentally incapacitated black man to try to win the New Hampshire primary in 1992 and now casting himself as the friend of the African-American community. We haven't seen any mainstream media outlets report this, even though I think it's relevant to today now that they're posturing.
And Thomas, final thoughts, 30 seconds on the influence the media has on this election?
Well, you know, the conventional wisdom is, of course, that the internet has turned all of this upside down. But I don't think that's the case. I think that their power is still very great, and we're going to. Although, then again, I mean, you got the New York Times essentially cheering for Hillary, and right into this you know electoral disaster for her. So maybe their power is finally receding. But we're certainly going to find out by the end of this year, aren't we?
Well, we might find out in just a couple months. Thomas Frank is author of the forthcoming book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Li Fong is an investigative reporter with The Intercept, and you can find their work at yourcallradio.org. Thomas, we'd love to have you on in a month when your book comes out.
You got it.
All right. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast our conversation about the documentary The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. The film premieres on PBS on Tuesday. In 1966, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale founded the Black Panther Party. One of the party's earliest activities involved policing the police. Nearly 50 years later, the issues the party championed remain relevant today. So what has and hasn't changed? And what can we learn from the legacies of the Black Panther Party? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.